We don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to start out with a UI bill. So, since I'm testifying, Representative Nelson's in chair.
What kind of bizarre motion can I make right now?
Someone's a chair.
That nobody's ever heard of.
We got any other amendments?
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will move House File 3093 to be passed and go to the floor. Ways and Means? Okay.
You get to do it twice.
Mr. Chairman and members, the unemployment bill is a bipartisan bill. It usually doesn't have much controversy. And Representative Sertich and I seem to take turns with this bill every other year. And this bill has been endorsed by Representative Sertich. He was at the meetings, UI meetings. Senator Anderson, Senator Rosen, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, NFIB, Association of Retail Merchants, Association of General Contractors, Minnesota AFL-CIO, UAW, Teamsters, Job Now Coalition, and Legal Advocacy Project. These are people that all sit on the UI Advisory Board. And the significant initiatives in the UI bill this year are it makes it easier for new labor market entrants to qualify for benefits, reduces the disincentives to work part-time while collecting benefits, exempts from denial with limitations individuals who quit work due to a child care problem, increases the fraud overpayment penalties, shortens the appeal time period, but requires all notices to specify the day of the week and the date the appeal time period expires. Basically, what we do in the last couple years with the UI Advisory Council, we eliminated penalties, we have used more technology, and we have made everything better. We have developed a shorter period of time for the UI bill to collect the money we need. We are still in deficit as we speak. Is that correct? Next week we get out of deficit. So
great.
We go in deficit. Okay. But it'll be for a very short period of time. 1 month. Time to be in deficit. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment that I would like to pass to make the bill the way we want it, and several oral amendments that Ms. Long will give us. The AO6-1303 amendment, and Mr. Nelson will explain that for you.
Yes,
You're going to move the amendment?
I'll move the amendment, yes.
Can't move the amendment.
Pardon me? We don't have a quorum.
We can talk about it.
Go ahead and explain.
Do you know of any members up there? Somebody get another member so we can get this thing rocking and rolling.
One more by side.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program in Minnesota. This amendment, it's fairly complex. We were having a little dispute with the United States Department of Labor under what conditions we are required to pay unemployment benefits to an individual who's never worked in Minnesota. but has worked in other states and wishes to combine those wages but collect Minnesota benefits. This amendment will make it very clear that Minnesota does not do that unless the United States Department of Labor formally rules us out of conformity with federal law. If they do, then we will in fact conform to federal law. I might point out the United States Department of Labor just informed us a week ago that they are going to rewrite the regulations, but they won't tell us when they will be. They have a plan to issue drafts next September. So this bill will Mr. Chairman, is that we will not have to be here next year if we pass this amendment, regardless of what the federal government does. Our law will conform to federal law.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nelson, in order to fill time here, you can answer a question that I've had about UI. As a former business owner with no employees, just another business partner, at one point I had to pay UI at state level, and then we had something in a bill last year or the year before that said you didn't have to do that again, but then I was really happy about that because it's essentially another income tax because I could never collect UI. Then my accountant informs me that there's some interaction with the feds and said, well, you're right at the cusp there and you're going to have to pay it either way. Can you explain what's going on with that and is there anything we can do about it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, I think it's fairly complicated. It has to do with federal tax credits and the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. Federal law provides full federal tax is $376 a worker, but you receive a 90% credit if you pay state taxes on the workers. Now, federal law covers business owners. State law does not cover business owners. What it does is works out for the very smallest business, because the federal tax is so high, you are in fact better off opting into Minnesota, paying Minnesota, and getting the 90% credit. If you are in fact have five or more employees, then you would in fact benefit by in effect opting yourself out and not taking the federal credit on yourself. So it depends on the size of the business. It works only to the advantage of a business which has five or more employees. So it becomes a trade-off, I suppose, on, and it partially may come about, depends on what your tax rates are. Minnesota taxes, you could, if you were at the maximum rate, it's fairly complicated, but Minnesota, you could pay up to $2,600 a worker. So if you were at a maximum tax rate or a high tax rate, you might be better off opting out on yourself and paying the $376 federal tax rather than the Minnesota tax. What it says is you ran a good business and never had anyone collect unemployment benefits. But that's probably going to be true if a business owner is the only employee.
Yeah. I might be sorry I asked, but we got a quorum now, so
yeah. We got a quorum, I'll call this to order.
And I will officially bring this
move the bill first.
Yeah. I will officially move this bill.
Okay, now that we got the bill before us, you want to move the amendment?
I will move the amendment. The amendment is numbered A06-1303.
And I think you said you had some oral amendments to this, sir?
And Ms. Long has some oral amendments, but let's pass on this one first.
Okay.
I think we're going to vote.
Okay, we're going to vote. All in favor of this amendment?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
Here.
Go ahead.
At this time, I'd like Ms. Long to give a couple oral amendments. As usual, her thorough examination found some errors.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I have two oral amendments that are to correct typographical errors in the bill draft. The first is page 4, line 24.
On the bill? Okay.
And we want to delete 60 and insert 600. Yep. And the second is page 21, line 10. Delete 20 and insert 30.
That's it.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move those amendments.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at actually the bill summary, and it talks about cancellation of overpayments going from 10 years to 15 years. Could you explain the why and what that gets us?
Don't worry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, this was kind of a trade-off. The current law provides for a dual penalty. It provides for an increased penalty to 50% if you've had a prior fraud overpayment. But because of how we structured it, it was a trade-off,
sure,
whereby we eliminated that. So now there's only one.
One penalty. Second. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Could you just tell me which part of the bill we're talking about here?
Article 2, Section 14. And I'm not sure exactly what page. I'm just looking at the book summary.
On the summary.
Page 7 of the summary.
Page 7 of the
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney. Law did provide, or law currently provides, for a penalty of 25% on your first fraud overpayment and 50% on your second one. Well, given how it was structured, we would have to keep records on whether you had a second overpayment for 50 years. And so we can't literally do that. So how do we figure this out? What we came to in the advisory council was a compromise. All right, we only have one penalty, and now that's been increased to 40%. But the trade-off would be, okay, we'll increase also the, because we're decreasing it from 50, if you've had a second one, we'll just increase the period of time to 15 years. Under current law, we'd have to literally keep records for 50 years on whether you've had a prior fraud. So we wanted to eliminate that, and the compromise we came to was this increase in the period of time before we cancel the overpayment.
Representative Mahoney?
Well, actually, I'm going to do something that will get me probably in a little bit of trouble. Long ago, and I don't remember how long ago, for no fault of my own, I got a couple of overpayments from the unemployment insurance. I went back to work and I just totally forgot about it. A couple, 3 years later, I was unemployed, and construction industry, that happens. I think your tax accountant's got a problem. I had 22 W-2 forms in 1 year.
Awesome. Good thing to hire out.
My question, though, is, can you define what fraud is? I mean, in a case like that where somebody gets a couple overpayments and 2 years or 3 years down the road they say, we overpaid you, we're going to take that $200 or $500 or whatever it was at the time out of your next check. Is that fraud?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, no. Fraud, 99.9% of them, is you're working while collecting unemployment benefits and not informing the department.
Okay.
These are felonies. If they were prosecuted, we prosecuted 280 people last year and we're talking about people who were overpaid over $2,000 or more. They collect the benefits, and they are asked every 2 weeks, did you work? And they say, no. And they were working and making substantial sums of money. Mm-hmm. So that's all we're talking about. Those. When do we automatically cancel those? A non-fraud, which is somebody made a mistake, is canceled after 6 years, the same as any other civil death. But I say these are criminal level, felony level actions here. We're saying to be able to get that money back, again, compromise on how big the penalty was done, and it was simply decided to extend the period of time.
Good, thank you. I don't have a problem with
my point.
Thank you. I want to make sure that you realize I didn't have a problem with the money coming back out of, in particularly my case or anyone else's case. Just kind of trying to figure out if someone could get charged with a felony for making even a simple or even a stupid mistake. And you explained it well, so thank you.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is in Article 1, dealing with the fact that you're changing the time limit, or I'm sorry, the better find it here, Section 6, it's on page 3 of the summary. Under current law, some small employers are permitted to pay the unemployment taxes on an annual basis, and you're changing that to a quarterly requirement. Why is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westberg, this is one of the big confusions. We've had substantial problems with the fact that employers, all employers required by federal law, must file quarterly. And so what actually current law does, that was modified a few years ago, because you used to have a separate tax form along with your wage detail. You must file your wage detail quarterly. We've combined those, so there's only one. So the real question is, when do you have to pay? Well, we've had substantial problems with employers who feel, if I only have to pay once a year, why do I have to file every quarter? And we issue penalties for failing to file, because that's required by federal law. You have to file that wage detail. Now, because it gets fairly complex, too, because there have been increases in the base tax rate because the trust fund is in deficit status or will be next week. So right now, you could find an employer who might be allowed under current law to delay an annual filing who could have a tax bill of upwards around $2,000. And paying quarterly is relatively simple now with the new system. You can pay electronically. You can push the money to us into our bank account. You don't even have to give yours. All done electronically. So we've made it easy and simple, and I think it's one of the problems employers have is trying to understand that you still have to file quarterly. And this simply would remove, I'd say, a lot of the confusion. We don't think it creates a hardship on anybody. And when you talk in terms of small amounts, actually, a large employer could have a tax bill, an unemployment tax bill, in the third or fourth quarter of the year, which could be relatively small. It could be almost nothing because they've already met the taxable wage base. So it really doesn't get down to the amount of money. It simply gets down to the convenience. And we think now paying electronically, 65% of all employers are now paying electronically in Minnesota. That simply removing it will get rid of the confusion. And certainly we've had a lot of problems because we issue a lot of penalty notices for failing to file, and then they call up and say, I didn't realize I had to file quarterly.
So Mr. Chair, so then Westbrook, the small business employer who has five or less employees isn't significantly affected by this? And
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westbrook, no, they're not.
Any further questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Gunther renews his motion to have House File 3093 passed and moved the taxes. The ways and means, yeah.
That's what I thought.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Representative Finstead?
This with me?
This is mine.
Representative Westberg, would you like to move this bill?
It's going to hell.
I would be
going to hell.
I would be happy to move Representative Finstead's House File 3618 to pass and go directly to the floor.
No hell.
To hell, then. Thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair, do you have an A1 amendment in your packets? It's just a technical amendment, Mr. Chair, that just gets the bill in the shape we need it to be in to discuss it.
Nope. Yeah, I have it.
Too bad.
Too late.
Gone.
Oh, next committee.
Mr. Chair, I was informed that you don't have the amendment. Someone just ran off with my copy to make copies. So maybe we can...
I was just wondering, Representative Finstead, can you do that amendment in health committee? No. Can't do it? I want to do it here.
Mr. Chair, Ann Martineau, Department of Human Services. There are just a couple of tiny references. Council has the amendment. And it could be done orally.
You want to do the oral amendment?
I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, members, oral amendment for House File 3618, page 2, line 1. Strike injury and insert harm.
Insert what?
Harm.
Harm? Okay. I will move that amendment. Everybody understand it? I will restate on page 2 of the bill, on line 2.1, strike injury, insert harm.
And Mr. Chair, there's one more amendment on page 32.
Okay.
Line 28, delete is. And insert will be.
Okay, on page 32, line 28, strike is and insert will be. Any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, I will move the oral amendment to House File 3618. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Bill, is the way you want it to be now, Representative Easton?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very quick. This bill is the DHS technical bill, and it's essentially making some technical clarifications and deleting some obsolete language and creating a little bit more uniformity on the way the statute is cross-referenced throughout. So with me, I have a couple folks from the department that can go through the five sections that pertain to this committee, Section 1, Section 23, 36, excuse me, 37, and 39.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. At the Department of Human Services. Section 1 is correcting a cross-reference in a Department of Health statute. We're doing this with their permission, and it just corrects an internal reference to one of our statutes so that it makes sense. And it's the definition of harm, just sex, and the definition of social worker. Section 23 simply removes a very obsolete reference to the AFDC program that was repealed and replaced by the JANA program in 1996. And by striking this out, it changes nothing. It's covered in the this is in the administrative fraud disqualification hearing section of our statute. Section 36 simply changes the placement of a provision in the adoption assistance program that pertains to eligibility for Native American children who are under state guardianship or the jurisdiction of the tribe. It was just incorrectly placed before. And the amendment that we made that changed is to will be is in this section, and it just makes clear that the adoption assistance certification has to be done prior to the final adoption. Section 37 amends language from last year. Last year, the department had a large policy bill that was carried by Representative Wilkins. And in the course of what we were doing was conforming state statute to federal law in the area of 4E foster care. And we worked along the committee through the committee process with advocates on behalf of family reunification. And this particular phrase wound up in just too many places in statute. And it's fully covered in the dispositional section of the statute, but we're removing it here so that this section comports with federal law.
I think Representative Mahoney has a question pertaining to this section.
Actually, Mr. Chair, it's pertaining to Section 36, where we were changing the tribal law. On page 32, line 28, where we made the amendment, where the child, we deleted is and made it will be. I guess my question is, were the Native American tribes involved in this particular amendment? Did you run it by them? I mean, I do remember, was it last year or the year before, there was some comments about tribal adoption and some of that. So how did that all come about? How did this come about?
This is not a problem. In fact, it was intended to be this way. And it is just moving it from one section of statute to another in this form. And it just has to do with adoption assistance and the certification for that having to be done prior to the finalization of the adoption.
So this is not new law, the three lines here?
No, it's just moving it. It's just technical. It's just putting it in the right place in the statute. Mm-hmm. So it's just moving the language stone.
Okay. And the Native American tribes are
would have no issue with this, Representative Mahoney.
I see how you moved it. Okay. All right. Thank you.
And then the very last section is Section 39, and in that same bill that Representative Wilkin carried last year, we codified the Alternative Response Program. It had started as a pilot and went to all the counties, and we were just simply codifying the practice and putting it in state statute. And in this particular place, we missed a criterion for the situations in which the counties would go on to further investigate other individuals.
Okay.
We're adding it in. This is the current practice. This is just making it clear to everybody in statute.
Okay, any questions? Seeing none?
On the whole thing?
You have a question?
Yeah.
Since you created most of these problems, I like.
When I was drafting all that work in the policy bill last year, I realized it was pretty technical and complicated, and I could have made a mistake. So thank you for coming and drafting my work. Ms. Martineau, I haven't had a chance to really review all this, and I'm just wondering, it's a technical bill, but are there any real policy changes in it, or is it all purely technical?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, there is absolutely nothing in the sections that we just went through that is anything but technical. New policy changes.
What about the whole bill? I mean,
I do not believe so, Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin. The department never intentionally does that in a technical bill. However, the rest of the bill will
be
well seen by Representative Bradley's committee tomorrow.
We'll see you there.
Representative Clark.
Just a quick question. Is that the same thing true then on page 9, line 9.25 to 26? Are those also technical, no new language? I just have underlined, so I'm just trying. Page 9.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I'm not personally familiar with this particular piece. However, there is some in the room, can speak.
Sure.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, where I'm the Director of the Licensing Division. And Representative Clark, yes, on page 9 there are some changes to the background study law. As you can see on the change on line 18 is striking criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree. There are a couple changes like that. There were some significant changes to the background study law last year. Criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree is now a disqualifying characteristic no matter how long ago it happened. And so it was added to another section, and in the drafting, the striking of it from this 10-year look-back section did not occur. So that's merely technical. There's a typo on line 19. Some numbers got transposed. Fraud in obtaining credit and financial transaction card fraud were also added as disqualifying characteristics in the other sections of the law, and they were just omitted from the 10-year look-back section. They're already disqualifying characteristics, but this really seeks some further clarity. There's a provision in the 15-year look-back section that says that if you have this conviction and the sentence is a misdemeanor, you're still disqualified, but it's for the 10-year period. And so this merely makes more clarity in the law. When we do about 200,000 background studies a year, and we disqualify about 5,000 people, and we really seek for internal consistency and clarity in the law wherever possible to streamline some of these conversations we're having.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the language is not new. It's just moved to 10 years from what was previously?
It more or less, Mr. Chair and Senator Clark, it more or less already exists in another section, but this is just providing more internal consistency within the law.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing then, Representative Westerberg renews his motion to have House file 3618 be passed and referred to Health Committee as amended. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Clark. Welcome to your committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm bringing the bill before you today that deals with making it easier for licensure of foreign-trained healthcare professionals, and there's an amendment that should be passed around. The bill as it originally was...
Do you want to move your bill?
I will move amendment... First, I'll move House File 3578 be passed, and I need to have a little bit of a conversation with Representative Bradley to see... We're going to see how this goes, whether he wants it or not.
He wants it. We have to refer this to health also.
Right. And then I'd like to further move the amendment H3578A1. And that puts it in the form that I'd like. And it's coming around.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members, this bill is something I've actually been talking with people about for a few years, but I had the opportunity to talk with a person who you're going to hear from briefly about just
why we need to do something beyond just hoping that people who are licensed in foreign countries will be able to get licensed here, and to help them overcome some of the barriers that are preventing that from happening, particularly in the healthcare field where we have shortages of certain folks. This amendment basically makes sure that the kind of assistance that we want to provide to foreign-trained licensed professionals covers all healthcare professionals. So that's what the amendment does. And I want to have us hear from one of our folks who's been dealing with this in Rochester, first of all. This is a problem all over the state. We have people who come here from various countries. They're highly trained professionals, and yet becoming licensed in our state to do the kind of work that they did is just, there's just barriers that stop them from doing, mostly financial. So I thought our job training resources would be a good place to go for some of the assistance here. I'm going to ask Mr. Randy Johnson to introduce himself and describe the project he's working with and why they actually need this bill to pass.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee
again.
Hi. I'm Randy Johnson, the Director of Workforce Development Incorporated. It's based in Rochester in a 10-county job training delivery system in southeast Minnesota. I've been asked to talk here today because our operation back over the last several years has been very involved with what we call healthcare academies, trying to pull people into a very needed profession that we've determined, and without a lot of effort, to know that we're very short people in healthcare professions. We primarily started by looking at nursing, certified nursing assistants, etc. We weren't primarily looking at foreign-born at the time, but we recognized that was a population that was ready, willing, and able. About last May, however, we were able to tap into some very limited federal funds from another project to allow us to expand to take a look at professionals within the healthcare field. We had known in Rochester area that there were a number of people in the community that had been trained as physicians in other countries that were in the community working very underemployed. Proposed that kind of an opportunity to take a look at these folks and see what would become of it. I had the blessing of having a gal on my staff that I think is wonderful. She's on vacation the other way. She'd be sitting here right now. But she was a former nurse and very familiar with the healthcare profession and a career guidance counselor. We proposed to this project to try to locate 25 people in the area, the healthcare professionals. And within weeks, she had her 25 people. It was not a problem. There were quite a few, and we still are quite a few in Rochester. Rochester, by the way, has some 50 languages in its vicinity. It's been an interesting proposition now for the last 9 months to see our 10 months, see how this has played out. What we found is that it's a very tangled web, depending not only on what profession you're proposing to go back into, to be certified in, but what country you've come from and what the trail is that you need to follow. To my surprise, if you're a physician, I guess I had thought we have a healthcare board certification here that would be taken care of here in the state, but if you're a physician, you need to go to Philadelphia physically to be certified. So there's immediately there's some transportation and some support service kinds of obstacles for people. These folks are oftentimes from have very large families. The majority of the folks that we are seeing, majority if not all, are actually in the refugee category. They have very large families, and even though both spouses are working, their income is inadequate to meet those kinds of needs. So we've been exploring as we've gone. We've been asked now by a special project out of Winona State to track what we're finding out, what the pathways are, so that other people can replicate this in the future. And that's very helpful. What we're finding, however, is that the folks don't meet the eligibility criteria for our federal funds, the Workforce Investment Act, to provide direct reimbursement or expense replenishment here for their support and their study materials and their licensure and those kinds of fees. So we thought this was a real neat thing. I had no idea that Representative Clark was working on this, but in looking at it, it's exactly what would fit into our experience, is to find that kind of additional funding to make sure that those folks can get certified.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Imelda Sanchez to tell you her story, and you can have a personal look at what this means in the life of a physician.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Imelda Sanchez, and my country of origin is Mexico. I'm a medical doctor there, allergy specialist. I arrived this country in 2000. I came here to visit some relatives, and at that time I decided to take a board of medical test because I thought it was easy for me to become a medical doctor here. But I found a lot of barriers. The most important of them is money, financial. I need to have $650 to take a test for medical certification, and there are three of them. Then that makes a total of $195. Besides that, you need to have books in order to study the current knowledge. If you decide to have a Kaplan system study, it's a lot of money. You need to have $3,000 available for each step. That will be $9,000. And you have more possibilities to make it. But you still are a human being that needs to eat and have clothing and other things. And so you need to work to cover these necessities. And if you work, you don't have time to study. Because of this, for this test, you need to study full time for at least one year and a half to get what you want. Actually, I'm working as a medical assistant in health educator in a community clinic. I would like to be a doctor, an allergy doctor here, and I expect to be. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I hope that we've demonstrated the need and actually the way that we can deal with this problem. And I found out, I believe that also there's a program in St. Paul that's trying to do the same thing, and I've talked with people at the Workforce Center. So the way to do this, the funding would come through this committee, and I talked very briefly with Representative Bradley about whether or not he wants to see this bill in the committee. I'm a little concerned with deadlines, if we can get it there and back, but the funding that we would seek would come from this committee. So I guess I need a little advice from the chairman of our health committee. Do you want to see this bill? What do you think? How we make
it? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think the policy we've had, as a matter of fact, I carried a bill this year in terms of licensing. I think the policy in this is things that our committee should see.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, then I guess that we would move that the bill, I'd move that the bill pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services, I guess. So.
Okay. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark and some others, thank you for your testimony. But I'm just wondering, is there a possibility that where you're working for whatever medical profession, since we're looking at the dollars in this committee, that they would be willing to support those dollars for you so it wouldn't have to come from the state, you know, paying that, but probably in each individual case, whoever was the sponsor or however you work that, whether they're working in that particular medical clinic, would that be a possibility? Or has that been...
I'll let Mr. Johnson talk about the kind of matching funds that they do provide their clinic and their out of their operation, and then I would like to address the community clinic situation. So.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruth, to understand your question, I would say that most of these people are not working in a health profession at the time, otherwise they may be sponsored by that healthcare place. How we fund the projects that we're doing right now, I mean, there's several pieces to it. How do you pay for a coordinator to go out and make sure that you find these folks and you counsel them, case manage them, and move them through that system? That is a decision we've made in our area, is to make use of our Workforce Investment Act funds to provide that funding for that coordinator that we have on staff. It was a decision by our board that this was so needed that we were going to do that with our funds no matter what. We have the obstacle, however, with eligibility for some of those folks to pay those additional support service fees. But I couldn't speak for the employer community as to whether or not they would be leveraged in this process.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. No, there's no
rule. Oh. What kind of dollars are we looking at? It's a blank number here.
Right. Sure, we were discussing that, and if we were to have several pilot programs, I mean several parts of this pilot program, one in the metro area, the one in Rochester that needs help to continue, we're talking anywhere from 200 to 400,000 is what we think we'd get. Out of that, we'd get 100 people, I believe, assisted, and I guess the numbers are a lot more than that, people waiting. You'll notice that we talk about people here. They have to meet certain criteria, you know, a specialty that's in demand, and that's not being met. I guess the other thing to say is I know that in Dr. Sanchez's situation, she's working as a nursing assistant in a community clinic that's trying to figure out if they can keep going. So there's certainly not a position to come up with. I believe it would be about $10,000, the $9,000 for the study materials, the preparation, and then another, I think it was $1,095 for the fees. So, you know, I'm thinking it's a very good investment on the part of the state in terms of what these folks, when their license, will be paying back very quickly in terms of taxes and services that we need.
Representative Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark.
Bradley and Mahoney.
I think it's a good idea. One of my thoughts for you to think about is developing a revolving fund where as they got their jobs, maybe they could pay back into the system or a portion back into the system for more money for the future. But mm-hmm. So I don't know if you thought of that or not.
No, I hadn't, but that's an idea. Certainly consider. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Yes. But my question was answered.
Okay, very well. Any other questions from the members? Seeing none, Representative Clark renews her motion to have House File 3578 be passed and referred to Health Committee as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. All in favor of that
motion?
Huh? Yeah.
Aye.
All
in favor.
Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Very well. Passed.
Now, really, thank you.
Representative Nelson, welcome to your committee. While he's getting ready, why don't we move the minutes of March 22nd? Representative Gazelka, did you read those thoroughly?
Yes, I moved them.
Representative Gazelka moves the minutes from March 22nd. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Going from one hot seat to another this morning.
You did a good job in the first one. I hope you do a good job in this one. Welcome to the committee. You want to move your bill?
I'd like to move my bill, and I believe it's for inclusion in the on the omnibus bill, possible okay. Inclusion.
That's correct.
And this bill is about getting money and maintaining the information system, the housing, the homeless management information system that all providers of homeless assisted housing for homeless have to go through. And I'll let Michael Dahl here explain the bill and go from there.
Welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I wish a bill like House File 3513 wasn't necessary. I like to come to this committee asking for resources to serve people. But unfortunately, there's a very expensive and helpful database that's needed for federal requirements to access many federal funds, and also because of the helpful information it provides for state funds as well to provide homelessness services. And that's called the Homeless Management Information System. That's part one of the bill. And there's an appropriation of $540,000 for 1 year to cover the cost of that system. The second portion of the bill is $110,000 for the Nonprofit Capacity Building Grant Program. It is money that there were reductions in the Housing Finance Agency budget last year. Part of the program that was cut was a reduction in this grant program that is used for planning in greater Minnesota to provide homelessness services. Communities in the metro area are known as entitlement districts by the federal government, and they receive their planning money from the federal government. But that money is not available to rural communities, and so we've seen a reduction in their planning dollars to provide services. Let me just say that in Minnesota and across the country, there are a continuum of care organizations that do planning to provide good services to people experiencing homelessness. It's through these continuum of cares that we have good planning for our family homeless prevention program, our transitional programs and emergency shelters are able to figure out how to refer people to the most appropriate service. It makes our programs effective. These continuum of cares meet quite frequently to do this coordination and also to apply for federal grants. And in doing so, when they can do good planning, they're eligible to apply for federal dollars. Each continuum of care is applying to the federal government as its own entity. It's not like the state of Minnesota receives a certain amount of money to do homelessness planning or provide homelessness services. Each continuum of care, like Anoka County or Southeast Minnesota, are applying as an individual continuum of care. And when they have successful applications to the federal government, we receive money to provide that service, those services. For the past several years, Minnesota has performed quite well. We've been able to leverage $20 million for each of the past several years, roughly around that amount, by doing good planning. And that planning happens through both the nonprofit capacity grants program for the consumer care planning and our HMIS system. I'm going to let Craig and Michelle talk about the details about those two programs, but it's important to note that we would not be able to access these dollars without those federal dollars, without these two programs in place.
Well, will our committee give you a name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Helmstetter. I'm with the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation here in St. Paul. That's a nonprofit social service provider here in St. Paul. I'm from the Wilder Research Center, which is the research arm of the foundation. We're a nonpartisan research office that we do a lot of research on a variety of topics ranging from child care and food shelf use to domestic violence programs and on and on. Some of our better-known research has to do with homelessness, and that's how we got involved with the Homeless Management Information System. So I'm here today. I'm the project director for the Homeless Management Information System. That's, I guess, the first part of the bill has funding, actually full funding for that project of $540,000. So basically I'm here to answer any questions you might have about the project. I did prepare this sort of one-page handout that you see before you, and maybe I'll just draw your attention. Michael kind of covered that first bullet there, that the system is directly related to a lot of federal funding. The second point there might be of interest to you. We're asking for a big chunk of money. This is an ongoing project, and so we do currently have over 150 organizations involved and 300 members. We do have some current funding, so that our current situation is kind of laid out there. Basically, a lot of our money is in competition with housing and service dollars, and funding it through the mechanism of the bill that's before you would free up those dollars to go directly towards housing and services. With that, I don't want to take up too much of your time, so if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I appreciate your time.
Very well. Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, thank you so much for what you're doing here to help people out. You know, this is certainly something that behooves us to work really hard in this particular area. But one of the things I'm always looking for is information on, you know, how successful these programs are. And like the third point here in the HMS, HMIS in the brochure here, the information you gave us, it says here basically one of the key tools for tracking progress under the plan, you know, it's aimed at eliminating this, but as far as serving as a key tool for tracking progress, do you have any statistics that show how successful you have been, or, I mean, how things are working? Because is this something where someone's homeless and then they're homeless for 3 or 4 years, you help them out, and the same person's homeless again for 3 or 4 more years, and then eventually homeless again? Or do you have any way of providing any accountability?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I that is one of the purposes of this homeless management information system. I guess prior to the system, an individual agency could keep track of how a person experiencing homelessness, the services that they provide to that individual, and how well they did while they were in their program. But there wasn't a system for keeping track of that person once they left an individual program. Do they show up in another shelter a couple years down the line? Do they show up in a different transitional program? And this database does just that. It helps to track folks not only in one agency, but across a region or across the state.
So, Mr. Chair, at some point we will see some statistics, someday. Okay.
Right. Mr. Chair, we're getting through our implementation phase right now, but in a year or so we should have some good data to show your way to show some results of these programs.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westerberg, it's not as bad as your, the question about whether or not we're able to track success. We are able to track success to a pretty decent degree right now. I can tell you the success figures for our family homeless prevention program. We can probably do that for many of the services that we offer across the state. What this will provide a common reporting tool for all of our programs. So it's not just success of family homeless prevention and transitional housing and shelter separately, but together, how are those resources coming together? What's also important is that this is a federal mandate, and so even if we were tracking the information and able to say it's any program was successful and it was working together, we'd still have to pay for the system to meet the federal requirement.
Thank you. Mr. Dahl, if the program wasn't successful, would you admit it?
Mr. Chair, I think I have actually in the past told you about homelessness prevention programs that have had state money pulled because they weren't successful.
Okay. Representative Stolik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dahl, I have actually, along the same lines as Representative Westerberg's concerns, is, you know, in early childhood and these studies with Art Rolnick, they track kids, and kids that get a good early childhood education have reduced costs in special education, juvenile justice, dropout rates. You would think with the homeless population, you could track them close enough to figure out what's working, what the interventions are, as well as reducing the overall population. And I think that's part of the frustration is when the governor uses terms like ending homelessness. Frankly, I'm a little skeptical about ending it, but boy, you'd think we could reduce it significantly if we really are tracking people and working with them and investing government money. And you know what? Some people, it's going to be a persistent problem, but it seems kind of frustrating. It seems like we should be making faster progress and see results. And we do want to come back and see some correlations in state money that goes to this. Ultimately, should what helping people change people's lives. I mean, that's what we do here. Mm-hmm. However, also helping reduce the homeless population.
Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slavik, we're asking, this portion of the bill is asking for money for a tool to track success, not to actually provide the success. The money that we get for shelter, transitional housing, family homeless prevention, the actual services are what show the success. And within those programs, there are ways to measure those things. This makes it easier to measure that, and perhaps in some cases to refer people to the most appropriate service, like getting kids some educational help that they might need, or seeing how someone progresses over time, how they've succeeded through a program. I'm not very pessimistic about can we end homelessness, because I look back 20 years ago where the number was much smaller, and it's not like in 20 years a bunch of people woke up and said, hey, I'd like to be homeless. is that something's changed that makes it harder for them to get the help that they need. What an HMIS system allows us to do, and it's actually the eventual plan, is that we're not just a homelessness service system that's using this information, but we can be working with hospitals, emergency rooms, corrections, mental health systems, the places where people would be caught before they become homeless, so that we could find out what's the most appropriate way to help them. And that help, right now, we see the homelessness services and the HMIS system is where they need to where we would be catching that information. But our hope is that we'll be able to have access to information that says, hey, what are the real needs of these people, so that they don't have to stay in the homelessness system as long and they can get the services that they need as quickly as possible to get out of that system.
Do we have any programs that will prevent homelessness? As long as you're identifying it before it becomes, is there any way we can prevent it? Is that probably a logical next step?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you're leading me into an answer you know the answer to. Mr. Chair, first of all, the best anti-homelessness program is a job.
Thank you.
Does that sound similar?
Thank you.
Is a job and it's housing, and we'll do all we can in that area. You're very aware that we have a statewide family, well, not a statewide, a homelessness prevention program that operates in slightly over half the counties in the state. It's not funded as much as it should be, and so in the counties that it operates in, we're not able to serve everybody that it could. But when we do get prevention dollars to the right households, we can prevent it.
Thank you.
And I hope that we can provide more resources for that. I would hope that I wouldn't have to be asking for money for the homeless management information system, and we could instead put money into this into prevention. I have one last point before we ask Michelle to come up and talk about how HMIS is used on a user basis, and then also about this $110,000 for Greater Minnesota homelessness planning. 6 or 7 years ago, the state provided $350,000 per year for emergency shelter on a statewide basis. This year, the state provides about $350,000 per year for emergency shelter on a statewide basis. The problem is double what it was 6 or 7 years ago. This bill that we're asking for is twice the amount the state provides for emergency services. Money to plan and the federal mandate of this HMIS system cost twice as much as the state is able to provide services for people. So I hope that we can get more money in services. But before we can do that, we need to be able to access them, which is what this HMIS system allows us to do.
Very well. Representative Clark, I think you have a question.
I'm going to pass.
Okay. Very well. Welcome to our community. Give your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Michelle Merksbauer, and I am here representing HMIS and also the capacity building portion of this bill. I've been a user of HMIS for nearly 2 years. I have been involved with the governing group, which has designed and created and enacted the HMIS system now for over 4 years. I see the promise of possibilities that HMIS has to offer, not only on a macro level, but also as a user. HMIS allows me to assess needs, track services, identify barriers, and document goal planning and case notes all in one place. I no longer need multiple programs or paper files to record all aspects of client management, as HMIS has provided me one system capable of handling all these facets. It saves time for me as a case manager to document my client, but also aids with client referral. If the partnering agency is also on HMIS and the client agrees to the release of information, I can share all or specific parts of my work with that client. This allows us to make the best use of our funds, which are limited, decreases client runaround and frustration, and makes more efficient use of my time as a caseworker, which enables me to meet with more clients. HMIS also allows me to pull reports from one source rather than data dumping multiple Excel files together. With proposed upgrades to the reporting tool, this will only become more efficient and provide more accurate, effective reports both to my agency and to my grantors. HMIS is set as a federal mandate, but has become a tool that I as a social worker rely upon to make the best use of my time for my clients and the resources available.
Thank you. Any other questions for the specifier? Seeing none, Representative Nelson removes his motion. They have House File 3513 be passed and incorporated in our...
Just laid over
for our amendment bill. So thank you very much. Appreciate that.
You're up.
Next.
Here. Welcome to your committee, Chairman Gunther.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This is a housekeeping bill, basically, of the redevelopment fund. And we do. We're cleaning things up all over. That's what keeps us in business, by the way. You think Bonnie, too, she said. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, I will move House File 3001 for possible... No, where does it go? Taxes. You really doing that thing? Okay. To be passed and referred to Tax Committee. Representative Sertich always gave me a bad time when the UI bill came up. It went to civil law for him. He says, these years are going to ways and means. But anyway, this bill does make some very important and needed corrections to the redevelopment fund. As you know, the redevelopment and contaminated cleanup fund is one that helps all over the state of Minnesota take care of blighted areas and blighted buildings, increases taxable property for all areas of the state. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have Ms. Mollich describe this bill.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
excuse me one second. Representative Mahoney?
I have an amendment to this bill.
Yes, you do.
Yes. The author.
And I do too.
An hour, or would you like it on later?
I think we might as well get several amendments. We can make the bill the way we want it to be.
And you just have to explain it all at one time?
That's fine.
If the chair does not mind, I'd like to offer amendment. I could put my glasses on and see it a little
bit.
A06.
Representative Mahoney moves the A06 amendment. It's your amendment, Representative Mahoney.
Pardon?
Do you want to discuss it, or should just...
The amendment is... we've got a witness here that can explain a little bit more, but it's kind of a physical description of where it can be done. I'll let Jim Cassery explain a little bit more.
Okay. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jim Casserly. I am a legal counsel assisting Minnesota Solutions and drafted the amendment. Appreciate having a chance to appear before your committee. I was a member of the House for some years and always enjoy coming back. I don't do it very often anymore. This amendment simply deals with, I drafted a language last year which allowed in biotech zones to use tax increment to assist with infrastructure. We thought we had drafted it appropriately, doggone it, you just can't trust attorneys. So over the course of the summer, it was determined that we needed to tighten up the language a little bit. What this amendment does is simply allow tax increment in a biotech zone to be used for public infrastructure. What it really is an exception to these arcane rules that deal with pooling in a tax increment district. What this simply says, the biotech zone's a larger area, and inside the zone, these zones are in urban areas, so we're always involved with redevelopment. And what it simply says is in a biotech zone, you can use the increment from an existing district to help only with public infrastructure. If you're going to spend it outside the specific district, you have to spend it in the zone, and it can only be spent for public infrastructure. That's the only exception. And what this amendment simply does is clarify the language which the legislature adopted last year, which we thought it addressed this, but this makes it clearer. And I can go into more detail if you wish, but that's what the language does.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's what it does.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion on the Mahoney Amendment, all those in favor, please say, Representative Clark.
I just want to ask what the author of the bill and witness think of that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, I think this was a needed amendment for the biozones, and I think it's very appropriate. We had to put it somewhere. This is a good place to be in it.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the Mahoney Amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The amendment passes. Chairman Gunther, the next amendment we have is the A2 amendment.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And basically what this amendment does is it gives, the way we did several years ago, it gives 50-50, 50% for Greater Minnesota, 50% for the Metro, and has one, still cancels, right? And it cancels, if one doesn't spend its money, it cancels into the other one. I think this is a fairness amendment. I think it's been before us before.
Any discussion on the A02 amendment? Representative Clark?
Could we see it first?
A2? A2 is the amendment? Don't have it?
No.
Trust me.
I don't think it got passed out.
Okay.
I have one right here.
Well, do you guys have the A4 amendment?
No.
No.
He's there for two, Ralph.
And A4. A2 and A4.
There's an A6 that would be a good idea.
Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment, if I remember right, it's an amendment designed so that we do not lose money if one area, be it urban, can't use all the money. We don't lose it and it goes back to the general fund, or if the rural areas can't use it, it doesn't go back to the general fund. It's an amendment that we do. We seem to have to do every year. We can't trust lawyers to get it right the seventh or eighth time.
Perhaps should I read it to the members of the committee? Was that
I think it's being passed out.
Okay, is it all right?
We
I think they're just. Chairman Gunther will allow the members just a minute to review the A2 amendment before proceeding.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick.
I have a question regarding the amendment.
Go ahead.
Representative Gunther, I just see one piece missing here, which is it's 50% to the metro area, 50% to the rural area, and now here at the legislature we really have a third category, which is the suburban areas. Does this reflect the makeup of the legislature?
I don't think that was the purpose of it. I think it was geographic area.
Isn't metropolitan?
This is redevelopment, and in the suburban areas, there are very few applications for the redevelopment fund because usually you see that where there is blighted areas, where there is money that from contaminated sites other than petrol contamination, and I think this is the only way the core urban cities can get more taxable property in many areas of the city of Minneapolis, St. Paul. There are, in Greater Minnesota, because of its age and stuff, you see more of it there. Suburban areas usually got to be a little more mature to get this. And you have more area than the metro area.
I possess
a lot. Mr. Chair, well, we have, in the, for the first-tier suburbs, like Maplewood, we have a lot of things, and in Oakdale, we have all those 3M, all that. Teflon's buried, and,
And
so there's
St. Louis Park with the creosote, and we have cleaned up many of those areas with these funds, and it, basically that's why we have the canceling part that goes in there. And the reason it was changed was Chairman Dorman and Langseth, I think we actually wanted the Greater Minnesota to be first. And I don't personally agree with that. I think the 50% each one should go to the other, and anything's left, whoever needs it should use it. And that's kind of the reason we did.
Representative Wilkin?
Well, just the clarification, the metropolitan area is usually referred to as seven counties, so it would include us in the suburbs too. I'm trying to figure out what this does and what it does without it. Do we have to have this 50-50 split? I mean, it seems like it's, if we did that, it's kind of artificial. If there's beneficial projects to be done in rural areas, who the heck cares if it's 100% 1 year there and 100% in the metro the next year? Let's just put the money where it's most needed rather than have an artificial 50-50 split.
Representative Nelson.
Basically, answer my question.
One time or forever?
The witness would like to.
Hi, welcome to our committee. Can you please state your name for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bonnie Bolich, and I represent Minnesota Solutions, which is a statewide consortium of cities and housing and redevelopment authorities with kind of a singular focus on older city development issues in the state. And the redevelopment account currently is actually only for Greater Minnesota. When we launched the program in 1998, it was a statewide program. We got funding for about 3 years, and then for a variety of reasons, didn't get funding for a couple years. And in those years, the program was changed so that it served Greater Minnesota only. So what this amendment, what this bill does as amendment, as amended, is restores statewide jurisdiction for the program so that the suburbs and inner cities can actually access the funds. And the portion that Representative Gunther was explaining just says that if by the program deadlines, one part of the state or the other hasn't utilized their amount, their 50%, that then it will be available in the other part of the state. But this is a very important amendment for suburban communities who right now cannot access the redevelopment account.
Any further discussion?
Chairman.
Representative Wilkin.
I guess I'll support it based on that, but I'd rather not have the artificial 50-50 and just make it so it's available statewide, and wherever the best project is, put it there. Where we hire all these bureaucrats to decide, and I don't think they have an axe to grind on metro versus rural. That's kind of inside the Capitol complex where that seems to be the biggest issue.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkins, I think it's the artificial axes that get ground by legislators that required the 50%, 50%. So, sad to say, but it's...
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The amendment passes.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right with you, we will go on to the bill right now. And
actually, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. There's one more amendment. There's the A4 amendment.
Yeah, we want to do the bill before this amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill has no fiscal impact. I want to reinforce that. And basically does three things involving two programs that are administered by DEED. One deals with blight, that's the redevelopment account. The other deals with contaminated land, which is the contamination cleanup grant account. And the bill, as we already discussed, does restore statewide jurisdiction for the program so that it would be available in all parts of our state, because redevelopment needs are wherever the older cities are and not necessarily just outstate. It also makes some changes in the contamination tax, basically a clarification. That tax was actually put into law in 1993, and it's kind of a complicated tax to explain, but basically does not generate a whole lot of funds. A very small amount, I think maybe around $50,000 a year or something like that. But the important thing to know is that when that tax was created, the intention was that tax be used for the contamination cleanup grant account. And so this bill merely clarifies that that was the intent for that tax. And finally, what it does is it makes a programmatic change in both programs that eliminates basically land acquisition costs as an eligible cost. And the primary reason for doing that is that land acquisition costs are part of any redevelopment project and are not necessarily a very good measure of redevelopment costs.
Any further questions for the testifier? Representative Clark?
I just want to make sure I understand that last part. They're not a good measure of redevelopment costs. Can you give an example?
Well, we could, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, we could have Meredith Udoivak, who's here from the department, talk about that. But essentially what the problem is that whether you have, no matter what kind of a development project it is, whether it's redevelopment or economic development or greenfield or brownfield or whatever, there are always land acquisition costs. So that in itself is really not a measure of redevelopment, of extraordinary costs related to the barriers to redevelopment. And so that's why we were going to eliminate that.
Representative Clark?
Well, I'm just thinking, there's some places. This may be the best idea, I don't know, I'm just trying to think it through. There's some places where the land acquisition, like say in an older city, would be extremely expensive, whereas in another community it may be almost, be very, very affordable. So by doing this, you free up the funding to go just to the... Is the funding still going to go for purchasing the land, or is it going to go... for the other parts of the redevelopment, or doesn't it impact that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, this would allow us to focus the funds more on the true redevelopment costs, which would be things like demolition and those kinds of issues. And
I think I understand.
Okay.
I think I get it. Thank you.
Any further questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Chairman Gunther, did you want us to visit the A4 amendments?
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Gunther moves the A4 amendment.
And Mr. Chairman and members, we have Kathy Haney here that's going to describe this amendment for us.
Thank you, Chairman Gunther. Committee members, my name is Kathy Haney. I'm one of those non-trustworthy lawyers from Bay Green. My client is the Dakota County Community Development Agency that does a lot of community development and affordable housing in Dakota County. This is, what I would view as another cleanup type amendment. It deals not with deeds programs, but the counterpart to deeds programs at the Metropolitan Council, the tax-based revitalization account, which is a cleanup program at the Met Council, and often works in partnership with deeds programs and generally has pretty similar kinds of criteria in order to make that partnership work. Under current law, the production of affordable housing and the preservation of and growth of living wage jobs are the stated goals of the grant funds for this program. And what the amendment does is sort of further defines what we mean by affordable housing, just to give sort of the staff some underpinnings of better definitions on what affordable housing is. And the definition we use came out of MHFA's Housing Trust Fund, which is sort of the most affordable program in MHFA. So I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions pertaining to the amendment? Representative Clark.
I think it's always helpful when we have these 60% of median income, 80% of median income, to have people know what those actual numbers are up to date, because they're constantly being evaluated. Can you write this on line 21, what 60% of median income is, and on line 24, what 80% of median income is, as determined by HUD?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, as I sat in the audience, I thought, somebody's going to answer that question, and I had a hunch you might. So I checked with Michael Dahl, too, and to both of our best recollection, current metropolitan area median income is right about $66,000, $70,000, somewhere right in there. And so I did a calculation based on $66,000, and that came out to just about $40,000 if you're at 60% of median. And at 80%, it's $52,800. But those numbers might be a little low if median income is actually more closer to $70,000, but it's right in that range, Representative Clark.
So it's $40,000 and what did you say? 80,
80% would be right about $52,800.
Okay. So those are the, and is that comparable to what we're doing with MHFA right now? I know we've changed the numbers in MHFA to allow higher income folks to be, take advantage of these programs, and I guess this would be doing the same thing. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, this actually came out of the Housing Trust Fund requirements under MHFA, which tends to be the program that focuses on the lower income part of the spectrum. So the Challenge Fund program tends to be the program that's for a little higher income. So what we try to do is keep the focus on the lower income end of the spectrum for purposes of these scarce grant funds. And
I think I understand.
Okay. Any further questions for the testifier? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. The amendment passes.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
I actually would like to propose an amendment, and I talked just very briefly with Representative Gunther about this. It's a bill that is in this committee, but I don't think there's going to be time to hear it. And I actually did alert people to this a little bit earlier, so I'd be interested in his response and also Ms. Bollock's response. What this bill, House Bill 3460, but I guess I'd like to move it as an amendment, Mr. Chair, so we could discuss it. Move it as an amendment to the current bill, and I guess the staff can help us figure out what we say to make it an amendment rather than a bill, but it just basically takes the language from this bill and makes it, declares it to be an amendment.
Okay, so this would be to this is the 3461 that's in front of me?
3461 as an amendment to Representative Gunther's House File. Huh? 3001. And I apologize for not being this earlier, but I'm just learning that we're not going to have a lot of time for hearings of all our bills. And this, since this is the same subject, I thought we might as well look at it.
So you can just insert, you can go ahead and say what you just said.
Mr. Chair, if you could just give me a general instruction to make the changes necessary if the amendment is adopted, then that would be fine.
So moved. Representative Clark, your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm hoping this will not be particularly burdensome or even controversial, but the business subsidy reporting, which we have been doing under 116J, again, as I mentioned the other day, again, this is a bipartisan supported effort to say that whenever we're doing public subsidy, there should be some accountability back to the public about what the results are in terms of jobs that are promised, wages to be paid, and so on. And so this is just another part of the, of the arena of support for economic development that I would like to see included. It was left out originally not for, I think, any very strong reason, but I think at this point it seems like it might be time to go ahead and put it under the business subsidy reporting. And again, it's an effort to have some accountability. What are we doing in terms of creating jobs? What are we doing in terms of wages? And I think especially the amendments that we've been working on now with public infrastructure and this last one, dealing with the Metropolitan Council and the housing, it's in the same spirit. So I'm hoping that the chairman will think it's a friendly amendment.
Chairman Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, as you know, I never really appreciated all these accountable measures that you want to put in there. I think we spend an awful lot of money on making sure this information is available, and I think basically if you would ask about individual projects that you have concerns with, the department can do that very readily for you. But with that, I would ask that the Department of Deed be able to respond, and
sure.
Ms. Udoybach is here.
Good morning. My name is Meredith Udoybach, and I'm with the Department of Employment, and Economic Development, and I administer the redevelopment program. Our suggestion would be that if, as Representative Gunther says, we track all the information on the programs that we award funds to, how many jobs are going to create, the tax base increase, how much money we gave them, if there's any housing involved in the project, the housing units, how much of those are affordable. So we certainly have all kinds of data that we're more than happy to share on the success or the return on the dollar for awarding these programs. Typically, as you know, under the redevelopment program, that's always been looked at as an extra expense to developing on site. So typically, well, the business subsidy law views it currently as not being a subsidy because it's taking away the extra cost to developing on the site. So I think it would be difficult to call those for projects to continue to proceed if we call those a subsidy. One suggestion that I have is, and I think we provided some language for to you, the redevelopment program statute currently does not require an annual report to the legislature. We have some language that we've given you, and we could certainly give that to you again to propose putting in a reporting requirement in the statute if you'd like. As I said, we gather all that data and be more than happy to supply it once a year.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the department. I've asked a question similar to what Representative Clark has put forth in this amendment. And the issue that I suspect Representative Clark, but I know I get kind of frustrated with, is he comes in and says, well, we made 500 jobs or 50 jobs at an average wage. Well, if you have one job that makes $1,000 an hour, but, you know, nine jobs that make $10 an hour, that looks like a really good average wage. So it'd be nice if we had if that's broken down for us, if this amendment doesn't pass.
Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark and Mahoney, one thing that you don't have my assurance on, if you ask questions to the department and don't get responses to the questions you have, I will accept this bill. In fact, I'll author it.
Mr. Chairman.
Clark.
Thank you. And I know you would do that. I know you're a man of your word. What is the problem, though, is, you know, I don't have the time to ask and ferret out every single project that comes before. And part of the beauty of having a reporting requirement is that it's put together in a book. You can look at it. We all get it delivered to our desk if we want. And you can go through it and you can see and we can make some judgments. It may be that this annual report would be a good beginning. I don't know what language you're talking about that you gave me. Was this recently?
Yes, Representative Clark, members. I believe it was last week. I was asked to email you some language that used to be
in the
statute.
All right, well, I haven't seen it. And I guess, Mr. Chairman, let me just ask this question. Does the annual report include this information?
Representative Clark, members, I think the language says it would, we could have the language say whatever you want, just say mm-hmm. whatever you want us to report mm-hmm. on, but it talks about the dollars used, spent, mm-hmm. where the distribution went, and the return basically on the dollar.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good start, and if you're okay with that, I would withdraw this amendment and ask so that we could put that language into the omnibus bill, I guess, or onto this bill, or however you'd like to do it. But I think we need to have something, to go forward. And actually, Mr. Chairman, I think you were co-authoring with me in that bill originally, so because there were a lot of good Republicans and Democrats who helped say, we just need to track this stuff. We need to know if we're actually producing the jobs we say we're going to produce. This is, as Representative Mahoney said, also the wages. So I'm going to just withdraw this amendment. I see you shaking your head at me. You'd like to say yes, you would work with me on that.
I certainly will instruct the staff to put the wishes of having a reporting part in a mention that in a bill.
Representative Clark presents her amendment for House File 3001. Any further discussion? All those in favor of House File 3001, passage and referral to the Taxes Committee. All those in favor, please signify. As amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes.
Thank you.
Representative Gazelka,
3133.
I'm moving. I'm trying. Representative Gazelka moves House File 3133 for consideration and possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair and member, I'll move that as stated. Just briefly, guys, this is a technical bill, a housekeeping bill brought forward by BEAD. It's already been to GovOps and Commerce Committee. It deals with three basic issues, unclassified positions in Explore Minnesota Tourism, And the Public Facilities Authority, number two, the Small Business Innovation Research Program, and number three, the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program. I've got Chuck Hamilton here, a deed director, to give any more clarification.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Hamilton. I am the Director of State Services for the Blind, part of deed, and as I indicated at the overview hearing the other day, wearing a different hat for this bill. I would note that one portion, section two of this bill, which is why the bill is actually here, is also in the governor's supplemental bill. However, the form that is in this housekeeping bill is the desired form, as there is a small amendment that's already been included in another committee. I will confine my remarks to section two. If there are questions about the rest of the bill, I would be happy to answer those as well. Section two is basically a codification of some rider language that the legislature put in during last session. It provided a base level funding for a new program, Small Business Innovation Research, and there was a requirement within the rider language to require fees and to develop a report back to the legislature regarding what those fees might be. That report was due February 1st. That was provided to Chairman Gunther as well as the Senate Finance Committee Chairman. That fee is about $75 a person. There is a fiscal note which has been included on this bill. We're seeing that it's going to be, you know, less than about $20,000 a year. In developing, after the last session, in developing the program, et cetera, it was determined by the Department of Finance that while the intent of the legislature may have been to that those fees remain with the department, that in fact there was no specific legislation, and therefore they requested that legislation be put forward this session. That is the net effect of Section 2 of the bill. If there are other questions about Small Business Innovation Research, we do have an expert here in the audience if there are questions.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I'm surprised that we're providing states consultation on a federal program on how to access it. Doesn't the federal government usually help folks access? Isn't there the Small Business Administration and folks like that help businesses access their programs?
And with that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik would like to bring up the director of this program, Ms. Betsy Lolfs.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Representative Slavik, the SBA... Oh, I apologize. My name is Betsy Lolfs, and I'm the program director for the SBIRS TTRS Assistance Program from DEED. The SBA does provide information. However, this is a very, very competitive project for small business. It's a high-tech technical proposal. And amazingly enough, the directions are not followed. The formative format is not taken care of, and that's what I do. I'm not a technical expert. I'm a formative expert, so I edit proposals. I teach them how to write in order for them to submit a good proposal so they can win.
Representative Spock.
And that's a good explanation. Does that $75 fee cover your costs?
The $75 fee is for the workshops and the programs that I'm putting on to cover costs, correct?
Any further questions, Representative Clark?
What is the what's the fiscal note on this? And is there a fiscal note?
Yeah, fiscal note is.
I'm just missing. Oh.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Clark, we're estimating that it's basically going to be less than $20,000 a year. We say that in the narrative of the fiscal note and actually in the table for fiscal year 07, we're estimating about $10,000 and fiscal year 08, about $15,000. We don't know for sure. It is an estimate.
Any further questions, Representative Clark?
Is this the part in Section 2? That's what we're talking about, right? Is that the part you're referring to?
Yes.
Not the Pathways Program, but the Small Business Access to Federation. Is that Small Business Innovation? Is that like the Defense Department? Is that what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the Department of Defense is one of 11 agencies that participate. They are the largest agency.
Representative Clark?
That's the most of this we're talking about is Defense Department money, right?
Most of it is. However, Minnesota is a high National Institute of Health state, and we get quite a bit of money from the National Institute of Health. Department of Defense has about $1.2 billion, and the National Institute of Health has about $560 million this year that the companies can tap into.
Representative Clark.
I would just like to see a report on, I guess, outside of this committee, I guess, it doesn't have to be through here, but I'd like to see what we're doing in terms of those, the breakdown of that funding, if that would be. If you can do that, I imagine that's easy to do. Thank you.
Any further questions for the testifiers? Seeing none? Representative Gazalka renews his motion to have House File 3133 laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Gazalka.
Mr. Chair, members.
And do we approve the minutes already?
Yep.
With that committee will be in adjournment.